there's no heaven. Susie, if you try, no hell below us, above us only sky.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Matthew LeClaire, and you are listening to Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI 99.5 FM. On today's show, we have Jacques Berliner Blau, author of How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. But first, I have a few events to share with you. The New York Society for Ethical Culture is presenting an advocacy forum featuring Susan Jacoby, the author of The Great Agnostic, Robert Ingersoll, and American Free Thought, interviewed by our friend Massimo Pagliucci. That's Wednesday, April 24th at 7 p.m. at the New York Society for Ethical Culture at 2 West 64th Street here in Manhattan. For tickets, you can go to nysec.org or call 212-874-5210. And the Delaware Valley Chapter of Americans United for Separation of Church and State will be holding the third Church-State Issue Symposium featuring keynote speaker Barry Lynn, the executive director of Americans United. It will be held at the National Constitution Center on April 20th from 9 to 5 at 525 Arch Street, Independence Mall in Philadelphia. He's a professor at Georgetown University's School of Foreign Service and the director of the Program for Jewish Civilization. He's written numerous books, is a regular contributor to Washington Post's On Faith column, and hosts the podcast Faith Complex. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you so much, Matthew.
So what interested you to write this book? And what was it about this topic of exploring what secularism actually is? What was that to you?
Yeah, I think a lot of us got interested in secularism post 9/11. And that's probably where my interest really, really peaked. And I think what set it all off is what is referred to in the book and elsewhere as the global revival of religion. And these were political groups across the globe who were re-entering public space and political space, some better than others. So I think that's what got me and a whole bunch of other scholars involved in studying this problematic.
Because I think a lot of people generally, as you explained in the book, don't really understand what secularism is, and they attribute it to just being atheism.
Yeah, I mean, I'm getting into a lot of really good conversations with colleagues. A lot of colleagues whom I respect are saying, well, secularism is atheism. Now, I think that's not correct, but languages change, people change, right?
Right.
So in colloquial usage, I have noticed that secularism and atheism are becoming synonyms. Ultimately, I think that would be very bad for both, that they need to maintain their separate identity.
So what is a little bit about the history of secularism? You talk about five particular people, Martin Luther, Roger Williams, John Locke. Tell us a little bit about these people and how they came to create the idea of secularism.
Sure. I mean, the thesis of the book, but I don't think it's a stop the presses sort of a thing, right? The thesis of the book is that secularism is really a Christian idea. It emerges out of a very particular type of Protestant meditation on the world and what is the best type of relation between church and state. If I really wanted to blow your mind, I could say, well, there's some scholars out there that argue that atheism is a Christian thing as well, that atheism grows out of very particular conversations within Christian theology in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries. But we can hold off on that. I think what secularism really is at core is it posits two variables, church and state, and then it worries about them, right? It worries about the interaction between these two variables. One of its solutions is separationism, right? That's one of the ways it assuages the worry. It says, well, we'll just put this big wall up between the church and the state, and everything will be better. There are other ways to be secular, but as you see, what I'm describing is a political philosophy, is a way of thinking about what the best type of polity is, given that many people are believers, right? That's very, very different from atheism, which is a metaphysical worldview, and I think a very interesting and legitimate metaphysical worldview, but its political views aren't necessarily always the same as secularism and vice versa.
And so when we get to people like Madison mm-hmm. and Jefferson, a lot of times quotes are used from both the right yeah. and the left. What are some of those conflicts that you write about in the book?
Well, the fault lies with the First Amendment. I know that sounds very, very harsh, but those 16 words are so elliptical, right? I think both sides have legitimate proof texts, right? So your hardcore Christian right that's arguing this was a Christian nation, it was founded as a Christian nation, if they wanted to pull out the texts, they could pull out the texts, right? The same holds true for the separationists. So separationists love Article 11 of the Treaty of Tripoli, right? And in response to that, the Christian right says, well, what about the Northwest Ordinance, right? Mm-hmm. Historians are looking at this issue pretty carefully. And I think one of the conclusions is that you probably would want to put your bet on the Christian nation side, at least at the time of the founding, that most of these folks, with the exception of the outliers who were Jefferson and Madison, most of these folks kind of did think in some way it was a Christian nation. Does that mean we have to live that way today? Absolutely not, right? This is a changing society. They believed all sorts of weird things back then that we can abrogate. Right. Nevertheless, there is evidence, right? There are quotes, especially from Washington and Hamilton, right, and the Adams, that indicate that they had no problem with a Christian America or even with moderate and gentle establishments on the state level.
So I wonder what the process is then for historians in particular when they're looking at all these documents. When I was reading your book, I came across this one section that talked about a bill that was supposedly written by Thomas Jefferson mm-hmm. and then proposed by James Madison mm-hmm. that was some sort of law to, I think the word was punish, Sabbath breakers.
Yeah, Sabbath offenders, right?
Right? Mm-hmm. And in looking that up, I noticed that there were all sorts of things that were related to that one specific part where, mm-hmm. you know, Jefferson was actually on a committee mm-hmm. that made the proposal. He didn't necessarily write it. It could have been based on something that was older. It was a revisal of the laws and not a new set of laws. True. How on earth somebody swallow all
but
this?
But they did do blatant types of actions that were so un-separationist-y, it's not funny. So Thomas Jefferson permitting clerics to pray, right, in Congress, James Madison proclaiming days of fasting to the Lord, right, in times of war and despair. So they're much more complex figures, right, than I think your average person tends to know. On balance, though, Jefferson and Madison are some pretty radical guys with really interesting radical ideas, mm-hmm. and they're way ahead of the pack, I think. I think they're far ahead of Washington, they're far ahead of Hamilton, of Franklin, of the rest of the cohort. And that's great. The problem is that I don't know if America ever really caught up to them, right? I mean, they were so forward-looking in their worldview. It took like 150 years for the right. United States Supreme Court to say, okay, is this what they meant? All right, let's try this.
Well, one thing that I read in Jefferson's autobiography, and this really struck me, but again, because it's by Jefferson, mm-hmm. and if the claim is that he and Madison were somehow outliers, then mm-hmm. this definitely calls something into question. But he talks about the bill for establishing religious freedom right. that was proposed, I believe it was in the Commonwealth of Virginia.
Mm-hmm. Not the state, right?
Right. Commonwealth right. of Virginia, where he writes about the process they went through in order to draft this piece. And he says that, quote, where the preamble declares that coercion is a departure from the plan of the holy author of our religion, mm-hmm. an amendment was proposed by inserting the words Jesus Christ. The insertion was rejected by a great majority, in proof that they meant to comprehend within the mantle of its protection the Jew and the Gentile, the Christian and the Mohammedan, the Hindu and infidel of every denomination. Mm-hmm. That seemed clear to me. And that's why I can't really get my mind around. I feel as if almost have we been missing something in our historical interpretations of these documents? Is it true that perhaps Thomas Jefferson was this hypocritical that in Bill 82, right, he would make this proposal of the bill for establishing religious freedom, and then two sections later in Bill 84, right, punishing Sabbath breakers? To me, it feels like maybe there's something we're missing, that there was some kind of argument perhaps that led the committee to sort of overrule him while he was still trying to get, you know, questions like that just kept coming to my mind over and over again.
I think with Jefferson, I mean, this, I mean, I'm not perfectly familiar with the document. I'd have to look at it.
The only reason I found it was because there's I was able to get my hands on a 48-hour trial of something at the University of Virginia. They call it the Rotunda,
right.
And I was, you know, looking through all the documents, and it's hard to find some of these things other than through these scholarly locations. The only other place you can really get it is by spending a couple thousand bucks online. So I understand why historians struggle with it.
Well, they're complicated figures, and they're not entirely consistent. And I think this might have to do with the fact that we're trying to strain the worldview of the late 18th century through the worldview of the 21st century. And often the contacts don't all come into connection, right? There are just disconnects that we can't understand. Again, on balance, he is the person that either coined or resurrected the phrase wall of separation, which is going to become one of the most momentous phrases in American history, right? So we have to, I think ultimately Jefferson, for all his complexities, he knew what he didn't want, right? Mm-hmm. And he didn't want these types of very, very close relations, right, between state and church. The more interesting question is, well, that's on the federal level. None of them wanted that. What did Jefferson think about this on the state level, right? We're pretty clear looking at his work in Virginia. He didn't want it there either.
Right.
But a lot of Jefferson's colleagues had no problem with state establishments of religion. I think it's a really important point, because it's coming back in American history. We're back to this issue nowadays.
And I guess at this point, in a way, it definitely is interesting to try and piece together these probably tens of thousands of documents that we have. It's probably more important to think now, okay, where do we go from here? Whether or not the majority of people who were drafting the Constitution in the First Amendment meant for it to apply, or thought that it would just apply to Christians.
Right.
Maybe we're addressing the wrong question when it comes to issues of church-state separation and who has the right view of Jefferson,
I mean,
Madison.
This is, your position is very radical, though I do wish somebody would resurrect it and bring it back. Some have, some law professors. To what degree are we shackled to the words of the Constitution, right, in their so-called original meaning? Now, I was trained as a Bible scholar, and I can tell you so many people try to get back to the Bible in its original meaning. And my view had always been, in a previous book called The Secular Bible, they end up not with the original meaning. They end up with a very present meaning, which is very, very dear to the interpreter. So I do think what would be great for secularism would be for legal theorists in particular, and I am noticing that they're starting to do this again, to kind of claim a little bit of sovereignty from the Constitution, to say, well, we can't get inside their minds anyhow. These religion clauses are very elliptical and cryptic anyhow. The floored debates that led Mr. Madison to write them are kind of puzzling to many historians. Maybe we should think about the year 2013, right? Maybe we should think about America today, right, with all due respect to the Constitution, and move forward, right, and look at the United States Supreme Court decisions, the interpretation of the original.
I just want to point to one of the sections where you refer to secularism as anti-democratic, illiberal, intolerant, and statist.
Right.
Was that a creative usage of the terms, or I guess what I'm really asking is, it seemed almost as if you were trying to light a fire under their butts and, you know, get people really thinking about what you're saying rather than focusing on the terms themselves, because clearly they're negative terms, but I don't think that you necessarily meant them in a negative way, not
right.
in every aspect.
Well, that is kind of, all right, let's be clear, that those terms I used to describe the inchoate secular vision, right, the secular vision of yore, right? I'd obviously like modern secularism, not to be anti-democratic, illiberal, intolerant, though it'll probably always be statist. One of the great things about being a professor and having tenure is you can say things that people don't like to hear. So I always take it as a sort of badge of honor that so many people on the right and the left have such a hard time with the claims in this book. Let's talk about the anti-democratic a little bit. Secularism is built on the idea, all right, and this comes out of a reading of John Locke, right, that any combination of state and religion, right, is just de facto bad. And there's this little aside in Locke's writing in the Letter Concerning Toleration where he says, and it actually really doesn't matter if the majority of citizens want there to be some type of collusion. That's just tough luck. And what I always ask my students in the Freshman Pro Seminar at Georgetown is, so what's he predicating that on? Like, what's his proof text? How does he ground the claim that it doesn't matter what the majority of citizens want vis-a-vis religion in public life? And we're all sort of mystified, right? There's nothing that he's basing it on other than what John Locke thinks is right. I happen to think John Locke is right. I happen to think if you don't create these types of barriers, you will have states that will go into rapid freefall, right? They will fall apart. Nevertheless, I think it's important, since I'm not an activist, I'm a scholar, it's important to be honest about what the secular vision is, right? And there's a profoundly anti-democratic element at the core of the secular vision, just like with race relations in the United States. Where would we be if we had listened to the majority, right, in the period of civil rights? The majority of Americans probably didn't want there to be full civil rights for African Americans. Thank God we didn't listen to them. And I think secularism keeps falling into that situation where it really is the better idea. It's the better way for everyone, except the majority hasn't necessarily recognized that.
Right, right. It seems almost backwards to think that the majority doesn't get to decide on these things. Right. But then when you really think about it, it is ultimately for the protection of everyone, as these things can change. The religious makeup of the United States can certainly change. And that's why I'm always surprised when engaging in discussions, well, I shouldn't call them discussions, usually arguments with people who consider themselves to be evangelical Christians. When I point out that, especially when it comes down to the public schools, one of the best arenas for these arguments to take place, they always seem to think that the exclusion of prayer inside of a public school is somehow anti-Christian. And when I point out, well, if a teacher was to get up in front of a class and tell the students that, you know, they better convert to Islam, I don't think they'd be too happy about it. And so there's an impossible, impenetrable wall, if you will, that separates one group of people who can understand the issue as a whole, trying to communicate with these people who cannot seem to comprehend or refuse to comprehend the idea that we need this because one day you guys might be the ones in the minority.
Let me give you an example of this, right? When I was lecturing out in Texas, I had a small group and I had a woman who came to me and she said, I'm an evangelical Christian and I'm a secularist. And I said, great, tell me a little bit about that. And she said, well, I was reassigned in Utah for 2 years and I put my daughter in the local public school. And one day she came home after school and she asked me about, I believe it was the miracle of the locusts, something like that. And I didn't know what the miracle of the locusts was, so I consulted my pastor, and he didn't know either. It turned out that it was some aspect of Mormon theology that was being taught in a public school. And she said to me, this is an evangelical Christian. She said, at that moment, I became a secularist because I understood the danger and even the sense of violation I had that my child, who's an evangelical, right, was receiving Mormon worldview right in the classroom, right? So what I try to do with secularism is, in an effort to build it out, I use that as the selling point. The selling point of secularism, right, isn't godlessness. It's not even that wall, right? It's this idea that it protects every American citizen from being subservient or subjected to a religion that they don't like. And that can be believers and that can be non-believers. It's a pretty straight-ahead principle, right? People have a hard time sometimes accepting it.
Well, and unfortunately, it almost seems as if the argument has to be drawn in such a way that it is about selfishness, survival.
Right.
And it
individual
I always,
or social? Wait, so which do you mean? I mean, for the survival of individual families with their kids, or for the greater good? It is a greater good sort of approach,
it
secularism.
Right? But I think it the way that a lot of people will adopt it, it will only come to their attention that it's important when it hits them directly.
Right, absolutely.
And that I feel is an unfortunate aspect of it, but I guess that's sort of the direction we have to take.
Like these Republican governors who all of a sudden have a son or a daughter who's gay, and then all of a sudden, poof, right now they support gay rights.
Right.
It's unfortunate that it has to come to that, right? But that is a great way of mobilizing people to your cause.
One point I'm going to try and challenge you on, and
please,
you can respond. It was in regards to Michael Newdow.
Oh, Michael Newdow.
Yeah, the person who tried to make a legal challenge for the phrase "under God" and the Pledge of Allegiance, and I believe on the money as well. You definitely referred to his move as not being pragmatic, which you know is definitely something that I can understand. But these secularists, these particular individuals, are First Amendment ambulance chasers, extremists who are hell-bent on suing department store salesperson and who wish them a Merry Christmas.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Having the phrase "under God" in the Pledge of Allegiance is something that is directly affecting a particular segment of the population who does not believe in a particular supreme being at all. It's not the same as people who would sue for, you know, somebody saying Merry Christmas to them. What do you think about that?
I'm a Washingtonian now. I'm originally a New Yorker, but when you live in Washington, politics is the art of the possible, right? So I've noticed that historically, secular groups have chased at these windmills, right? Here's one that's been in play for about 160 years, right? Getting rid of the tax exemption, right, for religious institutions. All right, you could try it. You'd probably fail, and you'd probably fail miserably, right? And then what? Now, if you read between the lines in my depiction of Newdow, there's a lot of respect for him. I see him as ingenious. I mean, a lot of the stuff. And I see him as brave, all right? I just wonder if in another era of secularism, I don't wonder, I know for a fact, when things were really run through five or six kind of major theorists and thinkers, if they wouldn't have said to a Newdow in 62 or 63 when, like, the Engel Vitali case was being heard, if they wouldn't have said something to the effect of, pipe down, all right, for the good of the movement, we can't pursue this. And I know that's difficult. I know it's hard, right? But I just feel that getting under God out of the pledge, right, as happened in 2004, is such a loser on the pragmatic level. It's going to turn so much public opinion, right, against non-believers, that just hold on to it as like part of the 25-50-year plan. There are much more pressing issues confronting non-believers today. So if I came across as like snarky and disrespectful, I actually didn't mean it about the individual who I think is estimable and is brave, right? I think the idea is politically ludicrous, not intellectual. It is politically ludicrous to pursue this type of activism under these circumstances.
Because you do say that he may be even right.
Right. And what I'm also noticing as this isn't really my expertise, but I did read a lot about startup atheist and secular groups across history, usually starting from the end of the 19th century to the present. And they were characterized by a stunning inability to make good tactical decisions, right? And again and again and again, and they often almost always implode, which is sort of the telos of a group of non-believers. And unfortunately, we kind of see that today with some groups, right? So I think the wiser minds, whoever those people are, whoever she or he is, they would ask, how can we make decisions, right, that accrue to the greater good of the movement, even if we have to make some sacrifices along the way? That's really all I was trying to say.
Yeah, it's got to be, it's a challenge. Well, I know it's a challenge because I remember high school, you know, and being somebody who never identified myself as a theist of any sort, the idea that I was somehow being singled out, I can understand why it is that people will have a hard time leaving that part alone, especially when you have these, as you referred to them in your book, revivalists, who are pushing so hard in the other direction.
And so effectively, right, in the other direction.
And I kind of wonder if is it the very fact that there is such a pushback in these respects from actual seculars who really do care about this separation idea that is causing the revivalists to, in some cases, push their movement forward.
On the secular side, there is tremendous and understandable frustration as to what has happened in this country over the last couple of decades. And you get these kinds of explosions from folks like New Doubt, right, who are just so angry and so outraged about what is going on in the schools and what is going on in the courts and the state houses, and it's fully understandable. But I think the whole movement has entered the moment of efficacious political action, right, as opposed to what I think are kind of nuisance suits, quite frankly, right? I don't think this is going to get secularism very far. In the example I cited, on the contrary, it took secularism back about five notches because you had George Bush and you had Congress and you had Democrats, right? You had Supreme Court, you had the entire country calling Newdow and his idea out. So maybe a more Machiavellian approach to the problem might be helpful.
So how did we get to this point? Mm-hmm. Going from the middle of the century to being at this point where people like Barack Obama will make some statements that are just so clearly crossing the line. There's certainly nothing against a president making his personal religious views clear, but in order to even be considered now for public office, you must show your Christian.
How'd that happen?
Yeah.
Let me start by telling you a story. We did a conference at Georgetown University on secularism, and I showed two clips. I showed Senator John F. Kennedy's famous 1960 speech to the Houston Ministerial Association, where he said, "I believe in an America where the separation of church and state is absolute." Right. And then I showed them Obama at the recent Easter prayer breakfast, where he's citing scriptures and doing a veritable Christology. Some people in the audience were crying, right? How did that happen? So that's your question. It's a great question. It's the question I set out to answer. It's a very complicated query, obviously, and there are about a dozen reasons. I'm going to give you the two, what I think are the two largest ones, all right? Reason number one, why do we have that change? The Christian right. When they re-entered the game post-1973, a little bit after Catholics did with Roe, and when Jerry Falwell bought conservative Protestants and conservative Catholics and conservative Mormons into this type of umbrella group, which he called the moral majority, it was almost game over at that point, right? Because these people are not dumb. These people are not hicks, right? These people do not lack the capacity to reason rationally. I think secularists should have far, far greater respect for what they wrought. And what they wrought was a complete realignment politically, speaking anyhow, moving evangelicals. Evangelicals used to vote Democrat, by the way, from FDR forward, right? That's no longer the case. So that's reason one. Reason one is the Christian right and their genius. You can call it evil genius, if you will, but I don't think Washingtonians think in good and evil terms. We're beyond good and evil, right?
Right.
As Nietzsche said. Reason number two, much more subtle, and this is, I think, one of the really original findings of the book. As I looked at who comprised that separationist coalition at mid-century, I was like, all right, so who was a secularist in 1952 and 1956? I kept coming to the curious conclusion that these were actually small marginal groups, right? So Jews, right? Jewish Americans were on the forefront of this sort of stuff, right? Certain types of Baptists, that's true. Certain types of liberal Catholics. Then people like high culture writers, novelists, pornographers who I mentioned who had real issues with freedom of speech, which was kind of ruining their business model, if you will, right? And it hit me. That's a really small cohort. So this very, very small group of Americans bravely at mid-century, right, managed to change the entire judicial thinking about where religion, right, and government are, how religion and government are supposed to interact with one another. But they were tiny. I refer to them almost as the Wizard of Oz. So here the Christian right, which is huge, right, which is like 25, 30, 40% of the American population, we might be able to legitimately say, well, they're part of the Christian right, re-enters the arena, right? And they want to open up like a can of whoop-ass, I guess, right? And get out there and smash these secularists. And what do they find? They find that secularism is something that is powerful but small. Right? Why is it small? Because its guardians, its sentinels, right, are all located in these elite institutions, right? Courts, right? Universities, elite media, right? Mm. And when you do the numbers and you do the math, you realize that that's not a lot of people, right? So secularism was born or took flight due to the activism of an incredibly small amount of Americans. And it was vulnerable as a result, right, to the type of counterattack, ferocious counterattack, which came its way from the Christian right. A third reason, and we can do this very quickly, I have no idea where secular leadership was in the 70s and 80s and 90s. I really think it was sleeping at the wheel, right? It had one too many gin and tonics or whatever it was. It was drinking. And it just lost sight of what was coming at
it. Did it not know what was going on, you think? Or was this somehow something the religious right was doing under the radar that we couldn't really see?
That too. I think this debilitating stereotype of the Christian right as a bunch of yokels, right, from the Ozarks, right, who don't know nothing, don't know no book learning, is so wrong. Right? I meet the Christian right at Georgetown. When I go to a conference at an Ivy, I meet the Christian right. They're all getting their doctorates from these elite universities, right? So what is this idea that these are a bunch of nincompoops? They're very, very intelligent people, and they thrive off this secular misunderstanding, right? That they're just I once described them as people, toothless people playing the gut bucket. You know what that thing is, right? Like Beverly Hillbillies. No, they're not Beverly Hillbillies.
You're listening to Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI 99.5 FM, and we're WBAI 99.5 FM because of you, the listeners, who are generous enough to donate your money in order to keep this station alive. We are still looking for donations, and you can donate at www.give2wbai.org, or you can give us a call at 516-620-3602. My guest today is Jacques Berliner Blau, the author of How to Be Secular, A Call to Arms for Religious Freedom. Okay, so we're dealing with these people who are, as you're saying, they're educated. Mm-hmm. They're highly educated in many cases. It's either genuine, complete misunderstanding of, the importance of science in many cases, where they talk about evolution in a way that is, as Don McElroy of the Texas Board of Education once put it, hooey.
Right.
How can they go through these schools and in some cases even major in biology, which I believe is the new Texas Board of Education head is from? Right. How do they get to this point of being able to do both and simultaneously be so intelligent and also say evolution and climate change is just a grand conspiracy?
Now, this might be too technical and too much in the weeds in terms of a response. I do think the advent of postmodernism, which comes from a totally different place, right, of postmodern forms of inquiry, which really level Enlightenment reason, and with a certain degree of justification, as the only way to know the truth. I think the Christian right made a lot of hay out of a higher education system in the 80s and 90s that was really starting to question Enlightenment rationality and the idea that there was this one truth and that democracy was the best thing, that liberalism was the salvation of the species. Oh, and you're a scientist, right? And that science, right, was our redeemer. Like, it's kind of not coincidental, right, that postmodern scholars in American universities and kind of ultra-conservative theologians in American universities have tremendous common ground, even though they come from completely different places, right? And the common enemy is liberalism, right? The common enemy is the Enlightenment. The common enemy is big science. Science itself probably ought to have spent its 80s and 90s looking a little bit more carefully at these postmodern criticisms, if only because they were so amenable to being exploited by others in anti-science crusades.
In the cases of people who are not exposed to this information, that I can understand. But to people who have this constant stream of information, to have that kind of immediate rejection, seems to be one of the worst things that you can do, in especially today when we're dealing with so many major world problems, that such reactions can cause immense trouble for
us. It is bewildering. On climate change, it is bewildering, right? That's much more bewildering to me than evolution, because evolution is kind of a complex thing and it's very, very abstract. But climate change, here we are in New York. I mean, what don't you need to say? How much more evidence do you need that something has gone really, really wrong? I actually have no explanation for it. One thing I do notice is the hatred of liberalism in the quarters I just mentioned, kind of the postmodern left, radical left, I would say, right? And the conservative religious right is so intense and so over the top. And liberalism has almost become like the word Zionism. It's almost become this bad word that you shouldn't say and you ought not ever pronounce yourself to be a liberal anywhere under any circumstances, right? Because it's assumed to be something very, very sinister.
Like a secularist,
right? Liberal secularism. Even though in the book I go to great pains to say there are conservative secular people out there and they're part of the movement as well. They're Republican secularists, right? Who really are nervous about what's happening vis-a-vis government and religion.
And to go back, I'm not a scientist for sure.
Oh, I'm sorry.
What he was referring to, though, I'm going to Columbia Journalism School to get an MA in science journalism.
Oh, that's good enough. That's close enough. You're there.
So I'm going to have a lot of process in learning about science.
You're speaking
to
a person who failed trigonometry, or you can just imagine about biology.
Oh,
so as far as I'm concerned, you're a scientist.
Don't worry. I struggled with algebra, so you don't have to worry too much. So in your discussion about how to be secular, you try to provide some ideas about how we can form a more positive idea around the term secularism. What are some of the ways that you think we can come to that point? And also, who are the types of people that you think we can bring on board?
Yeah, the negativity's got to go, right? And I think atheists and secularists are really having a good conversation about this right now, about how that's facilitated by the anonymity of the web and certain sorts of celebrities of non-belief who really kind of, I think, push the envelope. I think civility is going to be a major internal house cleaning sort of issue, right? What can be done? I think secularism, I don't want to speak for atheism, right? I want to speak for secularism. Secularism is going to have to rediscover its elevator pitch, right? And its elevator pitch to me is disestablishmentarianism, right? Disestablishment, that's a 10-syllable word, right? In other words, I sloganize it, secularism, freedom from religions you really don't like, right? Secularism has to get back to that very simple pitch. All right, telling me this is what it is. All right, all it is, rabbi. All it is, imam. All it is, father such and such. All it is, non-believer, right? It's just making sure that no citizen is ever subject, right, to the particular religious worldview of another. I think that's where secularism begins. What type of people, all right, and this is where the book really didn't make many friends, right? I argue that religious moderates are fellow travelers in all of this. They're secular. Of late, they're scared to call themselves secular because the term has this new connotation of anti-theism and radical godlessness, right, and vitriol towards the divine and ultra-skepticism. But the Reformed Jews, the liberal Catholics, the progressive Muslims, so many Hindus and Sikhs that I know, so many others, right, mainline Protestants, I assure you, they're secular, right? Disestablishmentarianism is something they profoundly believe in, right? So again, as a Washingtonian, you build coalitions. You bring like-minded people into the coalition, and you take it from there. I'd love to bring more women into secularism. That is a very, very big problem. Atheism, secularism, and humanism have these real kind of demographic peculiarities about them, and they share them, even though they're not the same thing, right? And one is where are the women, all right? I hope it's getting better. I think it's getting better. Where are the Latinos? Where are the African Americans, right? If I were part of secular leadership, this would be one of my to-do list on a post-it right on my computer, right on the screen, right? Work on these issues in terms of secularism. Make secularism a draw to African American communities, to the African American church. Make secularism a draw to Latinos, right, who are going to be one of the largest ethnic groups in the United States in 20 years, right? These are the types of concrete kind of grassroots proposals you'll find in the conclusion.
Do you think there's a way of maintaining the, what I guess I'll call the more hardcore atheist vision, talking about how in many ways, and when I think about religious moderates, certainly most of them are, well, part of my family, mm-hmm. My friends, right. You know, pretty much everyone I know,
exactly.
For the most part. I have some people who are on the more extreme end of that, but at the same time, I recognize that perhaps there are some problems with religious moderates, you know, because they pick and choose what they want to believe in a particular book that they say is, you know, I don't need right. to get into all of that, right. But is there a way to keep both? Is there a way for people like Richard Dawkins, for example, to talk about how harmful he believes religious moderation is while simultaneously saying, mm. however, mm. in order to keep my view allowable in this country and in order to keep your view allowable in this country, we have to work together despite those disagreements.
Yeah, I think, I'm not an expert in the writings of Dawkins and Hitchens and Harris. I've read a lot of them. I think at core, they're cool with religious moderates. I don't think they're...
They don't hate Barry Lynn.
Yeah, they're not tyrannical in action, right? There's a type of discourse there which is really ferocious and over the top, right? So it has the effect of making the religious moderates feel that this is not a place that they are in any way, shape, or form welcome. So I would really, really watch the discourse. The reason why I'd really watch the discourse, right, is I've learned historically that oftentimes one thinker will put an idea into play. And I'm thinking in particular, right, of Karl Marx in the Judenfrage, in the Jewish question, right, where he puts almost playfully all these like radical ideas about Jews, right, into this stuff, but they're picked up later, right, in the era of Lenin and the era of Stalin, right? I mean, they're picked up by Nazis, right? These ways of looking at Jews, right, that are just kind of throwaway lines about kind of, you know, all the terrible things that Jews do. I fear, in terms of the public responsibility of thinkers, when they say things that are so, so radical about other groups. And I personally would wish that atheism, as it moves forward, right, would really seek to avoid that. Because it can boomerang. It can 20, 30, 40, 50 years down.
It is really a difficult issue to address, because you do want to support mm-hmm. Freedom of speech. But at the same time, I know from personal experience that if somebody has a view that says, I hope people who believe what you believe start to disappear from this country, mm-hmm. obviously that's going to, you know, turn me away from wanting to work with you.
I call this enlightenment schizophrenia, because you've got two great enlightenment values tugging at your heart, all right? The first is untrammeled freedom of speech, which for many non-believers and believers in this country is the most profound American right there is, right? And that's a great enlightenment virtue. But there's another enlightenment virtue of toleration, right, of being tolerant towards others, even if you don't like them and don't respect them, right? So you've got these two enlightenment virtues pulling at you. Should I be tolerant or should I really express my mind? Should I be tolerant or should I really express my mind? And I'd love to see a kind of very finesseful theorist kind of explain to us how you can navigate, right, that contradiction.
Especially when it comes to the difference between talking about, you know, the idea, you're ruining the country, and then the other guy saying back mm-hmm. at you, you deserve to burn in hell forever. That's a tough thing to address and be able to talk about in a way that's respectful.
This is where professors come in, and I wish they'd more rise to the challenge. Some have. This is where radio stations come in. Civil society, right? There's so many ways for people. I feel we have some of the stupidest conversations in this country about religion, and I really wish we could raise the bar, and we could let the professors of religion, of theology, we could let the scientists discuss the philosophers of religion, we could let public intellectuals, journalists. I really would like to see a more heightened discussion of religion and irreligion in the public sphere.
So what is your 12-step program at the end of the book? If you were to describe sort of the main things that people should start to do aside from journalists. We covered that part.
I mean, open up the tent. Bring secularism needs people. That's one of my major conclusions. It really needs people. And focus on getting more people, not to call themselves secularists, like I am a secularist, right? But to use the adjective, I talk a lot about that, adjectivizing secularism, saying, I am a secular African American, I am a secular Muslim, I am a secular Jew, I am a secular Catholic, and all they mean by secular, right, is they mean they respect that classic time-worn distinction, right, that time-worn fear, I should say, that when church and state get too close to one another, it's bad for religion, and it's bad for the state, and it's bad for society writ large. And I actually think most Americans believe that. Even evangelical Christians, I think, believe that. And secularism has to reframe and recenter this discussion so that people, remember them? Lots of people, all right? So yeah, secularism, right. I'm cool with that. I'm cool with putting that as a small component of my identity, right? I think that's the way forward.
And what do people like me do who, you know, I would identify myself probably as a humanist. Yeah. I guess I would call myself a secular humanist to that. Yeah. But again, it's one of those circumstances where right now we have major organizations, Secular Coalition for right. America, for example, which so far from what I can tell is focused solely on non-theists. Do you think this will, what you're suggesting will come to pass, or
having done some work with Secular Coalition of America, I do think they're getting it. I think they're one of those groups that's really starting to understand that they can't go it alone, first of all, right? They just don't have the numbers. And I think Secular Coalition of America, look, it's a dialogue, but I think they are trying to think about the possibilities, right, of pragmatically working with religious others, right? So in a way, atheist movements and secular movements are starting to grow up in the United States, and that's positive. For all of us. To the person who's a secular humanist, I say with some irony, God bless you. That's great. It's a great identity. And I hope it perseveres. And I hope we live in a society where groups that have, it's a small worldview, right? But that groups with small worldviews, right, that might not be very, very popular are fully welcomed and fully enfranchised, and they have the same rights as everyone else. And the government treats them exactly the same as any other group. That's what I would hope.
So what's up for you next? What this is your fifth book now,
yeah.
And what's the plan now for?
You know how I said I was a Washingtonian.
Yes,
I'm too much of a Washingtonian, right? I'm so much of a Washingtonian that I'm contracting like Lyme's disease in Rock Creek Park. That's how much of a Washingtonian I am. I want to go back to literature. I want to start writing about Philip Roth and John Updike, okay. And it's kind of a secret aspect of my education that I've taught literature for a long time. So I'm just going to go back. I'm going to recede to the arts defensively to protect myself and lick my wounds.
Well, look forward to seeing what you come out with next. Thanks very much for coming on today. And I look forward to hopefully having another chat with you at some future point.
Matthew, thank you. This was a lot of fun.
I would like to end this show by reading you some words from Thomas Jefferson. The rights of conscience we never submitted. We could not submit. We are answerable for them to our God. The legitimate powers of government extend to such acts only as are injurious to others. But it does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no God. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. If it be said his testimony in a court of justice cannot be relied on, reject it then, and be the stigma on him. Constraint may make him worse by making him a hypocrite, but it will never make him a truer man. It may fix him obstinately in his errors, but will not cure them. Reason and free inquiry are the only effectual agents against error. Give a loose to them, they will support the true religion by bringing every false one of their tribunal to the test of their investigation. They are the natural enemies of error, and of error only. Had not the Roman government permitted free inquiry, Christianity could never have been introduced. Had not free inquiry been indulged at the era of Reformation, the corruptions of Christianity could not have been purged away. If it be restrained now, the present corruptions will be protected and new ones encouraged. Was the government to prescribe to us our medicine and diet, our bodies would be in such keeping as our souls are now. Thus in France the emetic was once forbidden as a medicine, and the potato as an article of food. Government is just as infallible too when it fixes systems in physics. Galileo was sent to the Inquisition for affirming that the earth was a sphere. Government had declared it to be as flat as a trencher, and Galileo was obliged to abjure his error. This error, however, at length prevailed. The Earth became a globe, and Descartes declared it was whirled round its axis by a vortex. The government in which he lived was wise enough to see that this was no question of civil jurisdiction, or we should all have been involved by authority in vortices. In fact, the vortices have been exploded, and the Newtonian principle of gravitation is now more firmly established, on the basis of reason, than it would be were the government to step in, and to make it an article of necessary faith. Reason and experiment have been indulged, and error has fled before them. It is error alone which needs the support of government. Truth can stand by itself. Subject opinion to coercion. Whom will you make your inquisitors? Fallible men. Men governed by bad passions, by private as well as public reasons. And why subject it to coercion? To produce uniformity. But is uniformity of opinion desirable? No more than of face and stature. Introduce the bed of Procrustes, then. And as there is a danger that the large men may beat the small, make us all of a size, by lopping the former and stretching the latter. Difference of opinion is advantageous in religion. The several sects perform the office of a censor morum over each other. Is uniformity attainable? Millions of innocent men, women, and children, since the introduction of Christianity, have been burnt, tortured, fined, imprisoned. Yet we have not advanced one inch towards uniformity. What has been the effect of coercion? To make one half the world fools, and the other half hypocrites. To support roguery and error all over the earth. Let us reflect that it is inhabited by 1,000 millions of people, that these profess probably 1,000 different systems of religion, that ours is but one of that 1,000. That if there be but one right, and ours that one, we should wish to see the 999 wandering sects gathered into the fold of truth. But against such a majority, we cannot effect this by force. Reason and persuasion are the only practicable instruments. To make way for these, free inquiry must be indulged. And how can we wish others to indulge it while we refuse it ourselves? And that's all, folks, for Equal Time for Free Thought today. If you missed any part of this program, you can visit our website at equaltimeforfreethought.org. Remember to tune in, pay it forward, and question everything.